to bring you a story that is just unfolding.
We need to eliminate all uncertainty before we take any action. It's certainly not a risk analysis they apply to other areas where they take dramatic actions, you know, the Iraq war being a glaring case in point.
The United States and China obviously have differences, but look at the things we have in common. We need a stable world to allow...
That's a big question.
Well, we got time.
If you don't know how to fix it, stop breaking it.
If we act boldly, we can make significant progress in reversing the potential
damage. We need to take some responsibility.
Cap and trade, you think that's really the answer?
Yeah, it is.
Short and sweet.
When you start cutting your energy bill, you start giving your city opportunity.
Welcome to Eco Talk, and that last quote was from Hunter Lovins, and we're going to be talking about her ex-husband, Amory Lovins, because he was the subject of an interview and a write-up by one of my heroes, journalist Elizabeth Colbert, who is joining me in the Green Street studios today. She has spent the last several years documenting the cost of climate change as it has been witnessed by humans around the planet. Those articles, first published in the New Yorker magazine, were compiled and expanded upon in her book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, that is being re-released as a paperback. When we look back at this time, this book will serve as a reminder that amidst the cynical politicization of science and the ever worse degradation of politics, there were people all over the planet who did not need reports and pundits to tell them what was happening because their very relationship to the earth was changing. In fact, we hear some of those voices regularly here on Eco Talk. In our second half, Environmental Working Group Executive Director Richard Wiles will tell us about the contractor that was reviewing the safety of chemicals, who also happened to be moonlighting as a contractor for, yes, the chemical industry. Finally, something for your children's summer reading list to add to the new recycled paper Harry Potter book. Writer Patrick Carman today will introduce us to a magical planet reminiscent of our own magical planet in his novel, Atherton, The House of Power. It's a cautionary tale, but a very dramatic read. I am pleased, as I mentioned at the top of the introduction, to welcome Elizabeth Colbert to our program. We've had you on, but not in person. You're on tour to promote the paperback release of the book. Highly recommend it, Field Notes from a Catastrophe. Increasingly, it's looking like we are facing catastrophe. You had an audience at a local bookstore in San Francisco. And I wondered, as you've been promoting your book since it came out and others that you've worked on, you know, how is the dialogue changing with the audience? Are you seeing more nods, you know, out there in the chairs, people really starting to get what you've been talking about? You've been one of the, you know, consistent voices out there trying to bring attention in these incredibly researched and in-depth articles for New Yorker.
Definitely. I think that people are more well-informed. They're very, very concerned.
Large part because of your work, truly.
Well, I don't necessarily want to take credit for all that. I mean, there's been a lot, you know, it's sort of since the series came out in the New Yorker in the spring of 2005, as I certainly don't need to tell you or your listeners, it's just been one report after another that has documented exactly, you know, what's going on, the speed of the changes that we're seeing, these, you know, certainty with which we can attribute many of these changes to human-induced climate change. So there's just been sort of a flood, to use a bad pun, of information, and I think people are increasingly starting to get it, and they're increasingly starting to see the effects. You know, if you're a gardener, you can see the seasons changing. So, you know, people do increasingly get it, as it were, especially, I'd also like to say, you know, out here in California, where we are right now.
Where the weather's pretty mild, but, you know, these severe storms we're seeing, you know, in late April, everywhere when I hear these, you know, reports, I think, uh-oh, could be climate change. And do you think the same thing? I mean, we can't tie any particular storm, as we always hear, to climate change, but we're just seeing such a pattern emerging.
Well, you know, it is, as you say, it's always incredibly dangerous. We've actually, you know, had quite a very weird winter in the Northeast, very mild to begin with. It was something, you know, it was colder on Easter than it was on Christmas, which I think kind of freaked people out a little bit. And now this terrible storm that dumped, you know, 5-6 inches of rain on places broke all sorts of records. So, you know, there are certain things like very heavy rainfalls that are consistent with, you know, climate models. And there are other things that are just, you know, freaky events that I don't think anyone could say yes or no whether they're related to climate change.
Last week we reported on the disappearing bees. That's something I'm sure you've looked into.
Yeah, that's a real mystery, you know, to what extent there's a climate connection there. People just don't know at this point, though a lot of people are looking at it very, very seriously because, wow, that's another terrible problem.
Did you see a report that it might be linked to our cell phone usage?
You know, someone just told me that. I hadn't heard that theory. I have no idea to what extent it's plausible, to be honest.
Since you published Field Notes, there are so many more field examples, as you just alluded to. Are you planning to do a sequel?
You know, that's a really good question. I am not planning to do a sequel, but I am thinking of, you know, how to sort of advance the conversation, as it were. And I don't know yet. So how's that? Stay tuned.
Let's talk about the article on Amory Lovins. I'm glad you wrote about him. What an interesting figure. He is uniquely the only person I have not been able to get on my one-minute show because I have to stick to 20-second sound bites. And it's impossible to pull a 20-second sound bite from him.
That's so true.
You know, you say in the article he looks like Albert Einstein, and obviously the genius has applied description. And he's also kind of a mad scientist, isn't he?
Yeah,
looks
he's
the part,
a great,
acts the part, but
he's
brilliant.
A great character, Amory, and he lives in a house that's built out of stone, has these huge, thick walls.
Right outside of Aspen, right?
Right. It's in Snowmass, up in a mountain. It's about 7,000 feet high. It can get very, very cold there, but the house has no furnace. And it's designed to basically sort of gather heat in the summer. It's so super insulated, and the windows are so super insulated that Amory used to joke that he could just play with his dog to create some heat. But actually, unfortunately, the poor dog died. So I don't know what exactly he does right now. But
besides hang his laundry,
exactly.
His jeans out on a clothesline.
Right.
He says it's okay that it takes 2 days for them to dry as long as you plan ahead.
That was sort of the metaphor for the story. You know, if we were willing to pay attention to a lot of things and not demand instant satisfaction, that we could perhaps see our way clear to sort of dealing with some of our problems. But
he gave the example, and you wrote about the building that could have been much more efficiently lit, but for the developer who wanted to not remove any clients because he might lose a little money while they retrofitted. And that's the kind of short-term thinking that's gotten us where we are today. That's part of the problem.
Exactly. And Amory goes around and he sees the world as a series of sort of, you know, decisions made for short-term gain. But if you looked at them rationally, you know, you could see how much money could be saved for everybody involved. But unfortunately, as you know, as everybody listening knows, you know, a lot of decisions are made just for that, you know, basically quick turnaround. How much can we get out of this right now?
You write about Amory Lovins' turnaround from just being a sort of scientific geek to taking on environmental issues. It's worth quoting here, if I may. Just read for a second. It gradually occurred to me that the problems I was working on were interesting but not very important, he recalled. Membrane kinetics, which I briefly dabbled in, would not be nearly as important as solving basic problems of energy resources, environment, development, and security, because it didn't much matter how well we understood these other matters if we weren't here. Simply but well put.
Right, exactly.
And he's a real asset to the movement. Controversial, I mean, but as you say, even those who don't like or respect him do call him a genius. So I suspect he may have more respect than affection, just because he reminds me of Bill McDonough a little bit, you know, just in a category of one or maybe
right,
two.
Right. And they approach things very differently, actually, Bill and Amory. But
just in the way that they're so mind bending, you know.
No, they're completely committed. And they, you know, and you know, the question as a question with anybody who, you know, sort of sees things in this systemic way is, you know, if you actually followed Amory out, you know, would all the world's problems be solved? And I don't know if they would be solved, to be frank, but it would certainly help. How's that?
Right. And I like how, you know, you commented that he thinks outside the box and he said there is no box. I mean,
right.
That's just the way
he
sees things
exactly.
Differently, as does Bill McDonough. And you kind of want to, you know, vote for them for, you know, ruler of the world, because if they implemented all their ideas, it just might work. What did you take away from your talk with him? Is he really going to be bringing us the future car and his whole obsession with megawatts? Is that reality based in your learned opinion as a journalist? I know you're not a scientist, but writing about science.
Well, I think that I absolutely think that, you know, the world, you know, once again, will, you know, much of the world is coming around to seeing the value of that. I mean, one of Amory's basic points is if you don't use energy, you've found a new energy source. And he likes to call Detroit, for example, the Saudi Arabia of nega barrels. So that's with an N, nega barrels. So in other words, a barrel of oil that we don't use is a barrel of oil found in a way. And if we just made cars more efficient, we would basically find the equivalent of all of Saudi Arabia's oil reserves, you know, right under Detroit. Calls it the Detroit Formation. So he has all these kind of funny, vaguely corny ways of talking about it. But when you boil it down to its essentials, it's simply that we don't treat avoidance of using energy as an asset. But it is. It's worth a lot of money. And it's certainly worth a lot of resources. And it certainly helps the planet. And if we started thinking that way, then we would regard resources differently. Mm-hmm. And I certainly endorse that. And I certainly think he's right. And you know, the problem is that actually, in many cases, resources can be pretty cheap, and wasting them, you know, can be financially, beneficial. So that's the problem.
Oil being a classic example of that. We're going to go to a break, but we'll be back with Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker Magazine right after these messages. Back to the program, and we might as well be walking on the sun. It's getting pretty hot in the southwestern U.S., and according to the latest IPCC report, we're going to see more droughts, permanent droughts, they're calling it, because of the effects of climate change. Who better than to comment on this than Ross Gelbspan, who's made this his career, writing about it, speaking about it. Before we went to break, we were just getting to the, you know, some of the problems that they're predicting are going to be with us. And what's your sense of how soon in terms of droughts, wildfires? We heard a lot about rising sea levels in the first report. This one seems to be sort of the hellish aspects of climate change.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that the scientists don't know is how fast this is going to happen. I mean, there is a little bit of a lack of candor in terms of scientific ignorance, again, because, as I said before, this stuff is happening so much more quickly than the scientists had anticipated. But in terms of drought, for example, they are anticipating much more severe drought in the whole southwestern part of the U.S., and all you need to do is look at Australia. New South Wales, which is the breadbasket of Australia, has been locked in what seems to be now a permanent drought for the last 7 or 8 years, and agricultural yields have fallen dramatically. And that's not just because of extreme weather. It's because of some more fundamental changes that are taking place in the planet. So real briefly, just to talk about that drought, there are winds that swirl around the two poles. And as the atmosphere warms, it actually accelerates, it intensifies and tightens the vortex of these polar winds. So what's happening in southern Australia is that the water that used to evaporate up out of the southern ocean and rain down in the agricultural areas, these winds have tightened, and so as that water evaporates up, it's being drawn back into Antarctica. And it's actually building up glaciers in the interior of Antarctica, and at the same time, it has created what is entering its eighth year as a really severe drought in Australia. So these are changes that are even sort of above and beyond the normal extreme weather events that we're used to, and those are the kinds of things that the scientists are very, very frightened about, and they cannot predict with any kind of accuracy the timing of these impacts.
One thing we do know is that the poor are already and will continue to suffer disproportionately.
Absolutely, and that's a major emphasis of this report, and it was also what Rajendra Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, spoke to when he was talking about the fact that the impacts of climate change disproportionately hit the world's poorest countries and the poorest people in the world's wealthiest countries. And that is very important to understand. And it's not because nature discriminates against the poor. It's because poor countries really can't afford the kind of infrastructures to buffer these impacts that the wealthy countries can. That said, in the really long term, it may be that really poor people in really poor countries are better off than people like you and me. Because if we hit a period of runaway climate change and things really take off in a way that scientists are terrified of them taking off, It's really people who are used to living close to the earth and close to the bone
and simply,
who are better prepared to survive than people like you and me who depend on our technologically insulated lives these days.
Interesting.
But that's sort of a long view.
And that's a silver lining in a small bit of good news in the otherwise bad news landscape. We would just have a little less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you Ross Gelbspan's prescription for guerrilla climate change rectification.
Well, it's not so much guerrilla because I've gotten great responses from other governments everywhere but in the U.S. But basically, there are three simple strategies that are very large and very doable. The main one of which is to change energy subsidies. Right now, last year, the U.S. government spent about $35 billion subsidizing oil and coal. The industrial world spent about $200 billion. We're saying take that money away from fossil fuels, put them behind renewables, and a number of things will happen. First of all, the oil companies will follow the money, and they'll become aggressive developers of solar power and wind and tidal power and so forth. And I think those subsidy shifts would also bring out of the woodwork an army of energy engineers and entrepreneurs with a lot of clean energy devices and a kind of explosion of creativity that would rival the dot-com revolution of the
90s. We're seeing that in Silicon Valley now. There's a rush to want to help.
Well, that's right, exactly, and we need a framework for that. So we need that. We also need a large fund to transfer these technologies to developing countries. Just about all poor countries would love to go solar. They have the most air-polluted cities in the world. There is no resistance to this in China and India and Mexico and Nigeria. They just can't afford it. And so we need a large fund. It's been calculated at about $300 billion for about a decade to set up clean energy infrastructures in developing countries. And then the third mechanism that really comes from a former utility company president is that would make this all work is a regulatory mechanism in the Kyoto framework, a progressive fossil fuel efficiency standard, whereby every country would increase its fossil fuel efficiency by 5% a year. And that means they generate the same amount of goods and commerce next year with 5% less carbon fuel, or they'd produce 5% more with the same amount of carbon fuel. And since no economy grows for very long at 5%, emissions reductions would outpace long-term economic growth.
Ross, I'm afraid we're out of time, but if people want to read more about your brilliant plan, read Boiling Point, How Politicians, Big Oil, and Coal, Journalists, and Activists Are Fueling the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do to Avert Disaster. Ross, thanks so much. When we come back, photographer Chris Jordan will show us up close what consumption looks like, captivating art depicting a consumption-crazed lifestyle, right after these messages.